This is VOA News. I'm Tommy McNeil. Records show the suspect in the apparent assassination attempt of former U.S. President Donald Trump was near Trump's golf course for 12 hours. AP correspondent Terry Spencer reports Ryan Routh has made his first court appearance after the apparent assassination attempt against Trump on Sunday.
He is facing two charges. He is facing a charge of possession of a firearm by a convicted felon. That relates to something that happened about 20 years ago in North Carolina when he had a standoff with police, and also possession of a firearm with an obliterated serial number. Together, those would put him away, if convicted, for up to 20 years.
Spencer says Routh appeared at ease in court.
He spoke briefly with his public defender before the hearing. He was smiling, he was laughing, he was just chatting with her. He did not seem like he was too nervous about anything that was happening today. The judge ordered him held without bond for now.
U.S. Secret Service agents opened fire Sunday after seeing a person with a firearm near Trump's West Palm Beach golf course in Florida while he was golfing. No injuries were reported. Officials say he is the person that fled in an SUV and was later apprehended by local law enforcement. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations has accused Israel's military of striking schools, humanitarian workers, and civilians in Gaza. It is a sign of growing American frustration with its close ally as the war approaches its first anniversary. Israel has repeatedly said that it targets Hamas militants who often hide with civilians and use them as human shields in retaliation for their October 7th attacks in southern Israel that launched the war in Gaza. At a UN Security Council meeting Monday, U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield was unusually outspoken against the Israeli military, saying that many of the recent strikes had injured or killed UN personnel and humanitarian workers were preventable. This is VOA News. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken heads to Egypt on Tuesday for his 10th trip to the Middle East since the war in Gaza began nearly a year ago. This one aimed partly at refining a proposal to present to Israel and Hamas for a ceasefire deal and release of hostages. Unlike in recent mediating missions, America's top diplomat this time is traveling without optimistic projections from the Biden administration of an expected breakthrough in the troubled negotiations. Germany reintroduced temporary controls on its western and northern borders on Monday, part of what Berlin says are efforts to control irregular migration and cross-border crime. Reuters correspondent Lucy Fielder tells us more.
German border police check a busload of tourists crossing in from France. Political analysts say they may be aimed at undercutting support for the far right and opposition conservatives ahead of state and federal elections. In Frankfurt, on the border with Poland, this resident welcomed the checks. Here in the border areas, we suffer from crime, she says, so it's very good. So the controls mark a setback to free movement within the European Union, one of its key pillars. The new checks have infuriated neighbouring states, who fear they'll have to absorb more asylum seekers and also worry about the impact on trade.
Violence among illegal miners in Papua New Guinea has now left between 20 and 50 people dead. That's according to a United Nations official on Monday. Fighting started days ago and is continuing and near the site of a landslide in May, estimated to have killed more than 2,000 people, according to the South Pacific Island Nations government. The UN's humanitarian advisor for Papua New Guinea said that the death toll of at least 20 as of Sunday was based on information from community members and local authorities in Inga province in the nation's mountainous inland. Hundreds of Sudanese men are living in tents outside an industrial warehouse in northern France while waiting for an opportunity to cross the English Channel. Reuters correspondent Arthi Payaparin tells us more.
This man from Sudan, who did not want to be identified, says he has no choice but to try.
I leave Sudan because there is war. Many war. Everyone kill us.
The channel is one of the world's busiest shipping lanes with strong currents that make crossing it on small boats dangerous. On Sunday, French authorities said 8 people died trying to get across. Earlier this month, 12 died in another attempt. The Sudanese man compares the situation of the men living here to Syrians that fled after war broke out in 2011.
The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration is closing two of its offices in China, a move that comes even as the agency struggles to disrupt the flow of precursor chemicals from the country that have fueled a fentanyl epidemic. I'm Tommy McNeil, viewing this.
to this September 17th. And here are some of the stories we are covering. The UN diverts $8 million in humanitarian funding to Nigeria's flood response.
We're all behind you, not only in sympathy. We will not spare any of our resources in this response. We will try also to refocus resources that will be designed for some other intervention.
Electricity in Zambia is in short supply as the country deals with a drought-driven energy crisis. Uganda's Electoral Commission declines to register a political party aligned to former presidential aspirant Dr. Kizza Besigye. The African Court on Human and People's Rights hears a case against the Tanzanian government over the treatment of albinos. Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera agrees to be his party's candidate in the 2025 general election.
Every 5 years, the party shall go to an elective convention, and the one who shall be elected as president of the Malawi Congress Party shall automatically become the torchbearer of the Malawi Congress Party at the national election.
And Russia and Iran are looking to snare and sway U.S. voters. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs has approved the immediate release of $8 million to support victims in flood-ravaged Maiduguri in Nigeria's Borno State. Severe flooding there last week killed dozens of people and displaced hundreds of thousands of others. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
The UN Resident Coordinator Mohamed Malik Foul announced the new funding to journalists in Maiduguri while visiting flood victims over the weekend. The visit was to assess the extent of damage caused by the flooding and to ramp up life-saving assistance. Foul announced the allocation of $8 million from the Humanitarian Fund to support disaster response and management.
We are all behind you, not only in sympathy. We will not spare any of our resources in this response. Probably we might not be where we wanted to be in terms of resources, but as we speak, we will try also to repurpose resources that were designed for some other intervention, to see how we can bring them towards scaling up and speeding up this response. We will prioritize our response around the immediate needs.
The UN has been providing hot meals and facilitating food airdrops in hard-to-reach areas cut off by flood waters. Last Tuesday, a dam burst caused millions of liters of water to pour into communities in Maiduguri. State authorities say the flood killed dozens of people and affected more than 1 million others. Many are taking shelter in camps. The disaster follows an alarming malnutrition crisis caused by conflict, climate change, and inflation in the region. Local residents say food prices have skyrocketed as a result of floodwaters washing out access roads and markets and farms. Borno State Governor Babagana Umara Zulum told journalists the full extent of damage remains unknown.
The unfortunate flood incident is perhaps the most devastating acute disaster that our state has suffered as far as we can remember. Many bridges are damaged and we are yet to assess the integrity of the bridges that form the main link between the two major parts of the city. The University of Maiduguri Teaching Hospital, which has the most up-to-date medical diagnostic and therapeutic equipment in West Africa, was flooded. And the functions of this equipment worth billions of dollars are yet to be ascertained.
Borno State is the heartland region of the Boko Haram terror group. The group's 15-year insurgency has sparked one of the worst humanitarian crises in the world. But the UN says humanitarian response plan for Nigeria seeking $927 million is only about 46% funded. In 2022, Nigeria's worst flooding in a decade killed more than 600 people and displaced 1.4 million. On Monday, the Nigerian Correctional Services announced a manhunt for more than 280 escapees from a prison destroyed by the flooding. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Maiduguri, Borno State, Nigeria.
As Zambia deals with its worst drought in 20 years, businesses and households are going for days without electricity. Experts say the severe energy crisis could worsen Zambia's already fragile economy and lead to massive job losses. Kathy Short reports from the capital, Lusaka.
Millions of people across Zambia are enduring up to 21 hours of power cuts daily, locally known as load shedding. Taonga Zulu, a Lusaka resident who runs a family farm business, told VOA that her livelihood has been hurt by the power cuts.
It has become nearly impossible to manage the chicken run properly as we rely on electricity for various aspects of their care. The lack of power has also prevented us from pumping water, which means our farm is slowly turning into a desert.
The Zambia Association of Manufacturers is a business association representing the interests of the country's factories. Association President Ashu Sagar said his members have not been spared by the energy crisis. He says big companies are struggling with the cost of running alternative diesel-powered generators, while smaller companies have no energy source at all. Sagar adds that some of the association's members have failed to meet contractual obligations with buyers due to the drought-induced energy crisis.
So the impact on the manufacturing sector is quite big in that small companies that probably could have no capacity to invest in alternative energy solutions like diesel generators have had to curtail their manufacturing operations.
Zambia's only public power utility company, the Zambia Electricity Supply Corporation, or ZESCO, said Monday that it does not have enough power to supply all hospitals. Media reports say some hospitals are turning patients away due to lack of electricity and water. ZESCO spokesperson Matongo Maumbi said the country's heavy reliance on hydropower generation has led to a national shortfall of almost 1,300 megawatts as the various water sources are drying up. Economist Emmanuel Zulu says the energy crisis is dragging down the economy and pushing up unemployment.
There is a slump in output and productivity in the economy, and this is going to affect GDP as well as employment, because most people will be left with nothing to do.
Worsened by climate change and the El Nino weather pattern, the energy crisis threatens national food security, water and energy supply, Zambia's President Hakainde Hichilema said earlier this year. In his State of the Nation address to Parliament Friday, Hichilema said his government is working around the clock to address the energy crisis.
Government is implementing a number of interventions in a bid to enhance resilience and reduce our dependence on hydroelectric power. We are promoting alternative energy sources.
Energy expert Johnston Chikwanda is optimistic that new measures like the removal of the bureaucratic hurdles that discouraged private companies from investing in energy production will yield results in the near future.
Looking at the extent of the measures which are currently being implemented and the strong praxis of leadership driving the energy sector reforms, I am convinced that this crisis is being invested better than how we previously handled the previous crisis.
According to the United Nations, Zambia, Zimbabwe and Malawi are among the countries in Southern Africa most affected by the regional drought that began early this year. Kathy Short for VOA News, Lusaka, Zambia.
Malawian President Lazarus Chakwera has agreed to be the presidential candidate of the ruling Malawi Congress Party, the MCP, in the 2025 general election. This paved the way for the president to seek re-election after the party unanimously nominated him for the race. Chakwera is expected to face stiff competition from former President Arthur Peter Mutharika of the opposition Democratic People's Party and Joyce Banda of the People's Party. Malawi Information Minister Moses Kunkuyu tells VOA's Peter Clotty that the prospects for President Chakwera's re-election bid are great.
The president came out to accept the call because the constitution of the Malawi Congress Party is very clear that every 5 years the party shall go to an elective convention, and the one who shall be elected as president of the Malawi Congress Party shall automatically become the torchbearer of the Malawi Congress Party at the national election. So this being the first time that the president has appeared to the party faithfuls after the elective convention, he just accepted that call to say You have elected me, you have placed your trust and confidence in me, and I am accepting it that as per the dictates of the Constitution.
Realistically, what do you think are the chances of the president to win re-election?
The president has performed beyond what people thought. Because if anyone comes out and says the truth about what we are seeing in the country, anyone will attest that President Lazarus Chakwera has delivered amidst the challenges, the economic challenges that have also been exacerbated by the natural disasters that affected our agricultural productivity, which is our main vein of our sustainability as a country. Despite all those factors, the president has still developed this country when you talk of infrastructure. So President Chakwera has put us on that footing. And secondly, there is an opposition that is disjointed, that has no focus, that has no vision, an opposition that has clearly demonstrated that it is clueless on what it means to bounce back from the opposition to go back into government.
Former President Professor Atta Mutarika is on record to have said that the country is worse off than they used to be 4-5 years ago, and that President Chakwera has not kept his promises to the people of Malawi, and that is why he thinks he will be thrown out for Professor Atta Peter Mutarika to return. What's your reaction to that?
Professor Peter Mutarika has never had kind words for President Lazarus Chakwera. Even before President Lazarus Chakwera was president, when he was in opposition, Professor Mutarika did make a statement to say as long as he is alive, Lazarus Chakwera shall never be the president of the country. Today, Professor Mutarika is alive and Lazarus Chakwera is the president of this country. During his time, this country was in perpetual electricity blackouts. And today, we do not have a few blackouts anymore. If that's a sign of no improvement, then Professor Mutarika could be right.
Moses Kukuyu is Malawi's information minister. He was speaking with VOA's Peter Clotty. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Buckley in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 17th. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. The African Court on Human and People's Rights is hearing a case brought against the Tanzanian government over the treatment of people with albinism in the country. Attacks on albinos, including killing for their body parts, is widely documented in some southern African countries. The plaintiffs allege that Tanzania has failed to protect persons with albinism from persecution, including attacks, killings, and mutilations. Michael Nyako is the Deputy Director of the Institute for Human Rights and Development in Africa and one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs. He tells me that the Tanzanian government failed to ensure the universal rights of persons with albinism.
In Tanzania and other countries around the region, there has been a significant number of attacks that have been reported where persons with albinism have been targeted and in many instances murdered for their body parts. You have instances where children have been abducted from their own homes, sometimes with the connivance of their parents, and their body parts are being mutilated for the purposes of being through the workforce. The second part of our case is also with regards to the kind of stigma and discrimination that persons with albinism face in Tanzania. Because of these superstitious beliefs, persons with albinism happen to be one of the most marginalized members of the society and are often ostracized, discriminated against. They're spoken about in very unkind terms. Some people even refer to them as walking cows or walking money in regard of this idea that you can make money out of your body part.
What is the involvement of the Tanzanian government in your case? What would you like for the Tanzanian government to do about this?
Our case against the government is the lack of security. That the government, being the one that is in charge of the territory, has an obligation to ensure that everyone who lives is secure and is not scared for their own safety, to the extent that they cannot leave their own homes because there is a potential that they are being attacked. And the reason why we blame the government in this regard is because, as we heard from testimony in court, the government has records of at least 74 cases of murders that have been committed against persons with albinism. And yet, they have only been able to secure 17 convictions. out of those 74 murders, which in our estimation marks a significant neglect in conducting proper investigations to actually find the perpetrators of these crimes, to ensure that they are prosecuted, and where the evidence supports convicted, to deter other people from engaging in this kind of heinous crimes.
The government might argue that you are doing the right thing by going to the courts, because as a government, it cannot interfere with the court.
Well, there are two levels of court here. The court that we went to is the regional court, which is supposed to provide some kind of guidance to African states on their human rights obligations. But at a domestic level, the state has the power of prosecution, and the court can only convict to the extent that you bring credible evidence and you pursue prosecutions diligently before them. So if you are only able to secure 20% or so of convictions, the only reasonable deduction a person can make out of that situation is that you're actually not seriously investigating these cases, or even when you investigate them, you're not putting enough resources and individuals who have the knowledge and expertise to prosecute these cases successfully, and therefore you are failing the victims. They have the obligation to ensure that there's compensation to the victims for the pain and suffering. And according to the government's own admissions, the cases that they were able to secure convictions, they never asked any of the courts to compensate the victims.
Is this an action in futility on your part? Because some may argue that the African Court on Human and People's Rights, like other regional courts around Africa, lack the muscle to enforce its own judgment.
That may well be true, and that would well be true about every international court. As human rights lawyers, we don't only go to court because we think a court has muscle. We go to court because we also want to raise awareness about the issue. So it's not only about whether the court has muscle or not. It is also about a recognition that harm is being committed, and that someone needs to recognize and to let the government know that they are failing the obligation to protect their own citizens.
Michael Nyako is the Deputy Director of the Institute for Human Rights and Development in Africa and one of the lawyers for the plaintiffs. He was speaking with me from Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. The Tanzanian government did not respond to our request for an interview. The Uganda Electoral Commission has declined to register a political party aligned to former presidential aspirant Dr. Kizza Besigye. The commission claims the People's Front for Freedom Party resembles another registered party. Supporters of the new party accuse the commission of bias. Reporter Mugumi Davis Rakaringi has more from Kampala, Uganda.
Uganda's Electoral Commission wrote the supporters of the would-be new party, saying it has colors that resemble those of the registered party, the FDC. The Electoral Commission also wants the new party to provide a full description of the identifying symbols, slogans, and colors. Supporters of the People's Front for Freedom Party presented a mobile phone as their symbol and red, blue, and white as party colors. Harold Kaija is a party supporter and acting general secretary of the FDC Sprinter Group. Kaija blames the EC for siding with the other faction of the FDC.
The decision by the EC to question our name, symbol and the like was a little in bad faith. You cannot say that People's Power Front is the same as People's Front for Freedom. UPC has blue. JMA has blue. NUP has blue. About 10 political parties have blue in their lineup. I think they must have had some kind of hangover about trying to protect the FDC.
Benito Vega, the Deputy Secretary for Publicity in the main FDC, denies party's involvement in the matter.
We have no any connivance with the Electoral Commission in as far as declining their registration is concerned. We hope our colleagues would comply and maybe look for any neutral color other than the blue and white that belong to the Forum for Democratic Change.
The FDC, former Uganda's largest opposition party, has been disagreeing over the years with the members joining the ruling government or forming new parties. Former party president Mugisha Muntu now heads the Alliance for Transformation Party. Both the speaker and his deputy were top leaders in the FDC. Gerald Woria is a political analyst in Uganda who teaches journalism at Makerere University. He says with the general elections coming less than 2 years from now, it may be too hard successfully to register a new party in the country.
They have to go back to the drawing board and probably see whether they are able to address the queries that the Electoral Commission has raised in their paperwork. But I also see that the Electoral Commission is trying to make their application very complicated. So I don't know whether they will be able to satisfy them on another attempt.
Waruria says another option for the Sprinter FDC would be to form a pressure group and align themselves with an already registered party. Supporters of the People's Front for Freedom Party have since submitted other requirements to the Electoral Commission. For VOA News, I am Mugume Davis Rwakarinji in Kampala, Uganda.
Donald Trump on Monday blamed his election rival Kamala Harris and U.S. President Joe Biden after he was targeted in a second apparent assassination attempt, saying their rhetoric about him endangering democracy is to blame. Trump's rapid politicization of this Sunday's incident, in which a man allegedly planned to fire on the Republican while he played golf in Florida, guaranteed that tensions ahead of the presidential election in 7 weeks would continue to boil. America's adversaries are ramping up efforts to impact the outcome of the U.S. presidential election and down-ballot races. VOA National Security Correspondent Jeff Selden reports on the expanding array of sophisticated influence operations taking aim at U.S. voters.
In the U.S. presidential race, the push to win over voters is in full swing.
We will save our economy. We will rescue our middle class.
It's time to turn the page.
But the competition, according to U.S. officials, has been joined by Russia.
President Vladimir Putin's inner circle, including Sergei Kirinnikov, directed Russian public relations companies to promote disinformation and state-sponsored narratives as part of a program to influence the 2024 U.S. presidential election.
Part of the scheme, according to the U.S. indictment, included mimicking dozens of news websites to influence how U.S. voters think about critical issues. The other part involved Russia state-backed media outlet RT, charged with funneling almost $10 million to a U.S.-based media company.
To pay unwitting Americans millions of dollars to carry the Kremlin's message to influence the U.S. elections and undermine democracy.
Russia's denied the charges.
This is Russophobia. This is an attack on freedom of speech. This is discrimination. And this is the dirtiest games of the U.S. and the deep state for manipulation during the electoral cycle.
U.S. officials dismiss such denials as laughable. An unclassified intelligence assessment issued earlier this month calls Russia the most active foreign influence threat to the upcoming election, aiming to boost the chances of former President Donald Trump. And then there's Iran.
We have observed increasingly aggressive Iranian activity during this election cycle. That includes recently reported activities by Iran to compromise former President Trump's campaign and to avoid an election outcome that it regards as against its interests.
U.S. intelligence officials say China has also been running a small-scale social media campaign aimed at hurting candidates thought to be hostile to Beijing. But whether U.S. deterrence is working is questionable.
I don't think so far this has really broken through as a top issue that most American voters are following, but it's really important for voters to understand what's going on and how they may be pawns.
Giving Americans lots to think about as they get ready to head to the polls. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September 17th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have an amazing Tuesday. We'll be right back.